This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents 100 Side Hustles, Unexpected Ideas for Making Extra Money Without Quitting Your Day Job. This is the author, Chris Guillebeau. Introduction. Each morning at 6:01 a.m. Eastern Time, I publish a new episode of Side Hustle School, my daily podcast. Every story features someone who creates a money-making project without quitting their job. On average, 40,000 people download or stream it over the next 7 days, and then many more listen later. Since I started the show on January 1, 2017, the stories have been downloaded more than 20 million times. But why? Why do people keep listening week after week, month after month, even though the essential lessons of starting a side business don't change much from day to day? I've thought a lot about this question, and I've heard a lot of feedback from listeners. As it turns out, people love the idea of making money without quitting their day jobs. Earning extra money without having to give up the stability of an existing job is a powerful motivator. And more than anything else, we respond to stories. For instance, Teresa Greenway, whose story you'll hear shortly, didn't know much about the world of online education, and she wasn't particularly skilled with technology. She'd recently hit a rough patch in life, leaving an abusive relationship, raising a son with autism, and even going on food stamps to supplement her meager income as a motel housekeeper. Through it all, one of her favorite things to do was bake. And in particular, she loved to bake sourdough bread. Everything changed when Teresa's daughter suggested she teach a course on baking bread. Instead of putting up flyers and renting space in her local community center, Teresa signed up with a service that would allow her to sell the course to anyone online. Using cheap equipment, she filmed Sourdough Bread Baking 101 and then released it to the world. That course produced $25,000 in net income for Teresa, a truly life-changing amount for her at the time. The next year, she created half a dozen other courses and made $85,000, more money than she'd ever made in her life. With the profits from her courses, Teresa was able to make a down payment on the first home she's ever owned. Or consider Kyler Russell, whose story you'll hear later in the book. Kyler started his side hustle with a little help from his mom, Brandy, when he was just 8 years old. Kyler loved baseball, but he didn't love the uncomfortable athletic cup he had to wear. Brandy and Kyler created a much better cup, one that was more comfortable, but still provided the necessary protection. Then they learned how to make it in bulk and sell it to parents of other young athletes. The comfy cup, as they call it, is now manufactured in Hong Kong and then shipped by the case to Lenexa, Kansas, where the whole family is involved in mailing the finished product to customers. It's not just a nice story, it's also a profitable one. The comfy cup is selling at a rate of more than $10,000 a month. They currently have a proposal in with Walmart and are hoping to break six figures in annual profits soon. These aren't startup stories of people risking it all, going around in search of investors to rescue them. They're stories of regular people with jobs, responsibilities, and busy lives who start money-making projects in their limited time. Most of the people featured in this book didn't even consider themselves entrepreneurs when they started out. Many still don't. They just wanted to make some extra money while holding on to the stability of the jobs they already had. Some of these people earn an extra $1,000 a month. Some go on to earn much more, sometimes even multiple six figures a year. And some of them have indeed gone on to quit their jobs. Whatever the outcome, most of us can relate to these inspiring stories precisely because they are about regular people doing things that almost anyone can do. I wanted to gather some of my favorite stories from the show and present them to you in this compilation. Maybe they'll give you an idea for a side hustle of your own, or maybe you'll just enjoy seeing what other people have done. Either way, I hope that you'll find these stories as inspiring and engaging as I do. Now, just one quick disclaimer before we jump in. I call this terms and conditions, and that is that there are a lot of facts, figures, and anecdotes mentioned in this book. Financial details were supplied by the people featured in the story, but with so many different case studies and dozens of locations, I probably got something wrong. And in fact, by the time you hear this, some of the info may have changed. In addition, some of the side hustles and websites featured here may no longer be active, or the people that run them may have switched to another focus of operations. This is totally normal. You don't have to do the same project forever, nor do you have to do it in the same way. In other words, the details will change with time, but the principles are timeless. All right, let's dive right in. Chapter 1, Real People, Real Money. Earning real money on the side isn't a fantasy, it's real life. Consider how these people created income and security for themselves, often in surprising ways. South Carolina man learns to bake candles by watching YouTube. After coming across handmade scented candles in a boutique shop, one man starts his own candle-making company. In historic Charleston, South Carolina, Mark Gaskins owns and operates a kitchen equipment business, which provides commercial equipment on wheels for wedding venues. The business is predictable, based largely on the spring and fall wedding seasons. Demand slows to a trickle during the cold winter months, as well as the hot summer months. This job was originally a side gig he did while he was bartending. When the bar he worked at burned to the ground, the kitchen equipment business became Mark's full-time job. Another important reason to start a side hustle, you never know when you may have to rely on it. During the downtime in his new job, Mark began his new hustle, buying wholesale candles from a local company and selling them on Amazon.com. He'd place orders with the company, they'd ship the candles to Amazon, customers would order, and Amazon would ship the candles to them. The model is called Fulfillment by Amazon, and you'll hear about it in a few other stories throughout the book. Now, that was a nice starter project. Soon, however, Mark realized he'd make more money if he manufactured and sold his own brand of candles. His aha moment was when he walked into an upscale men's store in Austin, Texas, and saw a 9-ounce candle selling for a whopping $85. On the flight home, he began to develop his own brand. He called it Meeting and Market. How do you learn to make candles if you've never done such a thing? Well, you do it just like the ancient Egyptians did. You log on to YouTube and start watching videos. Mark took pages of notes while watching countless video tutorials from a company called Candle Science, which happens to be the largest purveyor of DIY candle supplies in the country. After his free education was complete, he went to a craft store, bought some supplies, and started messing around. He gave away more than 200 candles to friends and family as part of the trial and error process, which contained more errors than works of art. His initial candles were white wax and clear glass with a white label. The design felt very retro, and not in a good way. He wanted something more modern, so he started searching far and wide for glassware until he found an amber cube he really liked. With the new glassware and a redesigned label, sales took off. The biggest issues Mark has dealt with have been with supplies. Glassware shortages, label issues, a bad batch of wax, a bad batch of oil that didn't mix well with the wax, and so forth. He also worries about receiving large orders and not being able to meet people's needs due to glassware issues. Mark's candles cost about $7.50 to make, and he sells them for $16 wholesale, $25 at markets, and $32 retail. Expenses include supplies, advertising, and the chunk of sales Amazon takes, so his net profit on Amazon is about 50%. In addition to selling there, he also sells at farmers markets and in some retail stores, as well as on Etsy and through his website. Popular scents include lavender chamomile, red ginger saffron, and blackberry sage. In his second year of business, sales were $43,000. His goal is to make at least $5,000 a month in Amazon sales, in addition to his other channels. Other goals include increasing wholesale buyers through trade shows and eventually making Meeting and Market a national home goods brand, all while continuing his commercial equipment business during the wedding season. He's burning the candle at both ends, but at least these candles pay him back in real money. And here's the critical factor for this story. Now, by the way, at the end of each story, I'm going to give you this critical factor. It's usually a couple of sentences that explain why this particular hustle approach worked. So in this case, critical factor, expensive candles provided the inspiration, and YouTube served as his classroom. From there, Mark made batch after batch of candles, improving craftsmanship and branding each step of the way. Woman on food stamps earns $178,000 teaching people to bake bread. Overcoming a difficult situation, this woman rises to the top with a series of online courses teaching the art of baking sourdough bread. Teresa Greenway's love of baking began when one of her daughters decided to try to bake authentic sourdough bread. The daughter gave up after a month of trying, but not before making a passing comment that would change Teresa's life. "No one can make real sourdough bread, Mom. Not even you." Teresa liked a good challenge. There's nothing quite as motivating as someone saying you can't do something. She would go on to try her hand at baking sourdough over and over, proving the prophecy wrong and becoming an expert baker. Unknowingly, the work she put in paid off years later as she was able to monetize her expertise on a website that broadcasts online courses all over the world. But she wasn't always a tech-savvy baking instructor. The year before her hobby became a serious source of cash, Teresa had just left an abusive relationship and had barely any income of her own. She had to juggle multiple part-time jobs, including one as a housekeeper at a motel. She was even surviving on food stamps for a while. Teresa wasn't able to work full-time because she had to care for her adult son, who had a disability, all while her mother was suffering from a terminal illness. The situation was bleak until she attended a workshop that opened her mind to starting a business. She then took some courses on the online learning platform Udemy, which gave her all the information she needed. The courses were diverse, ranging from YouTube channel management to photography and video editing. They cost $10 each at a discounted price, but for her at the time, it was real money. It was also an investment in herself. She had the idea to create her own course, and she had just the topic in mind, baking sourdough bread. She knew there was a market for online courses. After all, she had just purchased a few of her own. Perhaps it would be possible to create her own course and then get others to buy it. In those early days, Teresa didn't have much in the way of fancy equipment. She had no professional camera or high-quality editing software. In fact, she didn't even have a real kitchen. She used a makeshift space in her garage with poor lighting and a cracked, stained concrete floor that didn't exactly spell professionalism. Nevertheless, she persisted. It took her 4 months to launch her own course, but she did it. That first month, she made $1,000 in revenue. By the end of the year, she had made more than $28,000, all from a course on baking bread. Sometimes the best form of marketing for your project is to think about extensions, where you create the next logical solution for people who've purchased the first version. That's what Teresa did for her courses. She continued to create more Udemy courses over the next 2 years, eventually ending up with 10 of them. Did she branch out from baking? Nope. Instead of going wide, Teresa went deep. Her next course was also about sourdough bread. She called it More Fun with Sourdough Bread Baking. So were, in fact, the next five. Professional sourdough baked at home. Extreme fermentation. Bake modified gluten sourdough bread. Make your own sourdough starter. Capture and harness the wild yeast. Discovering Sourdough Part 2, Intermediate Sourdough. And Discovering Sourdough Part 3, Advanced Sourdough. If you're a video gamer, you might call that last one the hard mode of bread baking. Attempt at your own risk. The result of all this filming with flour, she made over $86,000 in year one and an additional $90,000 in year two. Along the way, her profile grew as well. She now has a following of 50,000 people spread like butter across her social media accounts with another 5,000 on her mailing list. It's a solid sourdough foundation for expanding her hustle and growing it even further. The extra income and financial stability from pursuing her side hustle has literally changed Teresa's life. In that first year of her first course, where she went from being on food stamps to earning $86,000, it was the most money she had ever made in a year. It allowed her to quit the part-time housekeeping job and put a down payment on the first home she'd ever owned. Being able to combine her passion for helping others with baking has brought Teresa great joy and financial security. Her story proves that you can create a profitable side income from doing all sorts of things. Your idea doesn't need to be cutting edge or something no one has ever heard of before. You just need to stop loafing around. And here's the critical factor for this story. When people think of online courses, they tend to think of topics that relate to technology. But Teresa's mega popular bread baking courses prove that even classic skills can be monetized with the right approach and voice. And by the way, some of the stories in this book are going to have an action plan at the end. I think about 15 to 20 of the stories do. So here's your first action plan based on this story. Identify a specific skill that you'd like to pass on to others. Don't be too general. Teresa focused on sourdough bread, not just baking, and not even just baking bread. Step two, develop an outline of how you'd like your course to be structured. A basic model is to choose 4 to 6 modules, each consisting of a series of outcomes and milestones. Step three, select an online platform to teach your course. Teresa chose Udemy, but there are many other options. Alternatively, if you're comfortable with technology and already have an existing audience, you may not need to use another platform. What you'll give up in discoverability, you'll gain in greater profit margins. And step four, prepare your lesson plans, practice your instruction, and start recording. There's no time like the present. Flight attendant touches down on Super Bowl profit. A Dallas-based flight attendant capitalizes on the Super Bowl craze by providing rentals for the big game, putting homeowners in the end zone, and earning herself a championship payout. 51-year-old flight attendant Stephanie Rivers designed and launched her side hustle while facing some unexpected turbulence in her life. In 2010, she was let go of the airline she worked for and wasn't sure what to do next. But for as long as she can remember, in fact, as early as her Girl Scout days of selling cookies, Stephanie has been a hard worker. She's done door-to-door sales, moonlighted as an Uber driver, and even partnered with overseas physicians to market low-cost cosmetic surgery. So when faced with a stint of temporary unemployment, she asked herself, what's next? She made it through the rest of that year working in car sales and then signed up to work with a company that was renting out homes for the Super Bowl. That year, the game was held in Dallas, where Stephanie is based. She saw great potential for the business model, but she was also disappointed to see that the company treated both the homeowners and the salespeople poorly. She decided she wanted to take the same idea, but do it better on her own. And then she set about doing just that, launching her own business ahead of the following year's big game. Since Stephanie is a big Dallas Cowboys fan, the business was an easy fit. She understands and shares the excitement around the game. And she knows the event is the perfect opportunity to make money, since tens of thousands of people, all willing to throw lots of money around, pour into the host city. She also knew that each year the host city, stadium, and team owners all make money, but not necessarily the taxpayers. Furthermore, she learned that the Super Bowl often blocks off up to 75% of the host city's hotel rooms. They save those rooms for companies and affiliates, leaving few options for regular fans hoping to see their team play. Her new company, Touchdown Rentals, provides solutions to both sides of this equation. She gets homeowners paid and helps sports fans live a baller lifestyle for the weekend. The approach is simple. Ahead of the Super Bowl, Stephanie reaches out to high-end homeowners. Then she posts properties online of those willing to rent, connects her clients looking for rentals, and takes a commission for negotiating the deal. Although she has to compete with the likes of Airbnb, Stephanie says she stayed ahead of the game by creating all-inclusive packages for the renters. They get the house, a concierge to help with entertainment, maid service, and even private party planning. Each year since starting, she's rented at least 60 properties, from condos to five-bedroom estates, all priced at $1,000 to $3,000 per day. With the business now in its sixth year, Stephanie has landed a healthy profit, bringing in about $50,000 annually. Since the business is seasonal, this represents just a few months of work. On average, she typically works 15 hours a week, almost all of it leading up to Super Bowl weekend. The business has grown through a smart, low-cost approach to marketing. After randomly picking him up as a passenger while driving for Uber, she enlisted a celebrity spokesperson in NFL player Tobin Okorum. And she started throwing house parties where homeowners invite their friends over for free food and drinks while Stephanie explains the benefits of renting out their homes. Now Stephanie is working as a flight attendant once again. She uses that job to her advantage. While flying around the country, she carries promotional material to pass on to airports, hotels, and other venues. And since she's passing through most major cities, she can easily stop over to research the different neighborhoods and upcoming Super Bowl destinations. All this effort has been worthwhile. As a result, Stephanie has been able to purchase and renovate her own condo and is now renting it out for additional passive income. As for Touchdown Rentals, Stephanie hopes to improve brand recognition to eventually become the Airbnb of the Super Bowl. There are no penalties here. This hustle is safely in the end zone. Critical factor. When a large group of visitors arrives in the city for a major sporting event, they need somewhere to stay. Stephanie gets paid by connecting those visitors with homeowners interested in making some easy cash. Saddles for pet chickens. Yes, this is a thing. An Oregon woman creates an unusual product with almost $0 in manufacturing costs. Don't cry foul just because you didn't think of it first. Have you ever had a beloved pet? Jill Bong from Oregon had one, but it wasn't a dog or cat. It was a chicken named Speck. Speck the chicken greatly enriched the lives of Jill and her family until one sad day when Speck the chicken went on a long walk. Okay, let's just tell it like it is. Speck the chicken passed away, leaving the family in mourning. The cause of death was a molting injury. Huh? Yes, this is a thing, just like the product that Jill eventually made. Many domestic chicken deaths are caused by such injuries, but they can usually be prevented with a special kind of saddle or vest that is worn by the chicken. In memory of Speck, and to protect the lives of other chickens, Jill decided to develop a new form of chicken saddle. The existing saddles on the market all had a fatal flaw. They had to be laundered on a regular basis. Because of the difficulty, most chicken owners don't use saddles, which means their hens are susceptible to the kinds of injuries that cause Speck to die. Jill's innovative design used vinyl material, meaning that the vest didn't need to be laundered. They could just be hosed down or wiped clean. Another benefit, no more expensive chicken vest dry cleaning bills. After a year's worth of testing on her 80 chicken flock, Jill's chicken armor debuted for sale wherever chicken saddles are sold, which means mostly on her website. The mission statement of Chicken Armor is to help chicken keepers save time and money with that special design that makes the saddles easy to use. In addition to the troubling laundry requirement, other saddles had to be hand-sewn, which takes a lot of time. The Chicken Armor advancements allowed Jill to price her product lower than all the other saddles on the market. Operating costs are also very low. All Jill pays for is the cheap bottle material and then the packing and shipping charges when someone places an order. Most people who keep chickens don't keep just one. They tend to have a whole flock, or at least half a dozen. A single chicken saddle costs just $2.50, and Jill sells a pack of 100 for $75. By selling in bulk, Chicken Armor brings in a profit of between $500 and $3,000 each month. depending on the season or if they've had major media exposure. Since launching The Hustle, Jill has shipped saddles to proud chicken owners in all 50 states and to four continents. She's been featured in numerous media outlets, including the Associated Press, the New York Times, ABC News, and of course, Side Hustle School. No doubt there will be a rush on chicken saddles once this book is out in the world. Jill, I hope you've stocked up. And for everyone out there who needs to saddle up their chickens, now you know where to go. Or if you're ready to fly the coop yourself, maybe you need a project of your own. Critical factor. Other chicken saddles had serious flaws. Jill was truly first to market with a new design, helping chicken keepers, and the chickens too, across the country and beyond. Operations manager manages to make heavy furniture light. A Maine University employee uses her logistical savvy to deliver IKEA enthusiasts their goods at greatly reduced prices. Peg Donovan has worked in operations for the University of New England for more than 15 years. Over those years, she's mastered the tasks of budgeting, forecasting, and solving all sorts of problems. For example, when the faculty offices needed new furniture, Peg was placed in charge of selecting, ordering, and supervising the arrival and setup of hundreds of items. That kind of logistical savvy, and a sharp eye to see how to fit things in tight spots, served her well when she assembled her side hustle, delivering IKEA goods to customers in Maine and New Hampshire at a substantial discount to them, and a profit to her. The joys and perils of assembling IKEA furniture has furnished plenty of joke fodder for late-night comedians, but the company remains beloved for its inexpensive, durable goods. Assembling those goods, however, which are often packaged in large, heavy boxes, is enough of a challenge. When the store is hours away, the weight of the burden doubles. Peg knew this from experience. Her own trek to get to IKEA's Portland, Maine location took almost 5 hours round trip. But delivery charges could drive an IKEA customer crazy too. Their most popular item, a Billy bookcase that retails for $70, cost three times that to have it delivered to Maine. For a lot of New Englanders, it's like building a bookcase out of credit cards. The delivery idea came to Peg in a flash. While wrapping up a meeting at the university, she mentioned she was going to IKEA the next day. When people quickly asked if she could pick something up for them, she saw the angle right away. She figured she could drive to the store, charge a 25% delivery fee to save people money, and make something for herself on the side. She just needed a name for the project. With an homage to the retailer's Nordic roots in mind, she called it Sven Delivers. Experience in operations management has extended benefits. Peg signed up with Squarespace to design and publish her delivery business website. Then she started posting on Facebook, targeting young families and moms. She also got free exposure when a local newsletter featured her business. The biggest expense she had was buying a used van for just under $6,000. Once she had a larger vehicle, customers started arriving like a horde of hungry shoppers lined up for cinnamon rolls. Some of them didn't have a car big enough for furniture boxes. Others just didn't want to drive the long hours, and nobody wanted to pay those inflated shipping fees. Even so, Peg says she almost fainted when Sven got its first order for one of those $70 bookcases. Even with her business experience, the fact that someone would pay her through PayPal and trust her new service to come through shocked her. Since starting up, Sven Delivers has gone from earning several hundred dollars a month to nearly $2,000 a month. She's tripled her once monthly jaunts to IKEA to three and will now assemble the goods for an extra fee. Her customers don't even need their own screwdrivers. Of course, happy customers only come through great service. Peg is focused on the customer experience. She texts, emails, sends out invoices, and confirms delivery times. The Sven Delivers site has plenty of testimonials from pleased people, spells out delivery options and timing, and provides several ways to get in touch. Continuing to work full-time at the university, Peg spends about an hour processing orders and answering delivery questions each weeknight, plus a chunk of hours on the weekends for the actual trips. The success of the business has given her the confidence to explore other ideas, so much so that she now has two other side hustles in progress. Neither of them requires screwdrivers, but it's clear she already has all the tools she needs. Critical factor. IKEA furniture is loved, or at least purchased, by millions of people around the world. And if you don't live near a store, delivery can be expensive. Peg used her background in logistics to bring bookcases and standing desks to people in her area, earning a steady profit from customers happy to pay for a more affordable delivery option. And this story also has an action plan. Step one. Identify a store, product, or service that isn't easily available in your area or to people in your circle. Step two, test the waters by asking around, does anyone want me to pick something up from? Step three, if there's enough interest, announce a service that will deliver the desired items direct to customers' doors. Step four, set up an online process where people can select the items they want and schedule delivery. Step five, buy, lease, rent, or borrow a vehicle large enough to contain a substantial supply of items. And step 6, hit the road and grab a lingonberry muffin for sustenance. Law student creates morning routine journal. A law student and two friends create a side hustle helping others hack their habits for more productive mornings. Habits have always played a huge role in Ari Banayan's life. He wakes up early, meditates, and exercises. While he was in his second year of law school, two friends approached him about creating an app to help people develop healthy lifestyle habits. They went to dinner that night to run through ideas and then met a few times over the next month to start fleshing out ideas for an app they wanted to call Every Damn Day. They started by each putting $3,500 into the company. They spent that money on an email newsletter service, a Shopify store, a social media scheduling program, and other applications. Next, they created a free accountability partner email chain called Partners in Grind, where they'd match up people with similar habits so they could hold each other accountable. To do this, they created a landing page with a form where people could sign up, select a habit they wanted to work on, like exercise, meditation, eating healthy, or waking up early, and share their geographic location. Users would then receive a series of emails with specific content related to the habits they signed up for, and they'd connect with other users interested in the same habit. Ari and his friends marketed the service however they could. They used Instagram and did a question and answer session on Quora. They reached out to self-help websites offering to guest blog. And in those posts, Ari would mention Partners in Grind. They also purchased social media shoutouts, where influencers would mention the service to their large groups of followers. As a result of the marketing and media coverage, they had hundreds of signups within a few hours. Partners in Grind died out, however, when they learned through user interviews that email wasn't the right way to connect people for something like this. People wanted to be matched with others for accountability, but found that email was a difficult way to connect, and it was hard for partners to stay consistent. This wasn't the business they would stick with. Still, Partners in Grind helped Ari and his partners get their name out, build an email list of 6,000 people, and test out the concept of matching people for accountability. For their second attempt, they decided to create Morning Sidekick, a journal to help people wake up earlier and build a morning routine, which was the habit that the majority of their users were interested in developing. Ari wrote the introduction and put together some content. One of his friends organized it into sections and added more content, and the other friend worked on the design. They launched a Kickstarter campaign and promoted it to their email list. They also reached out to YouTube channels and podcasts related to habits that they'd mentioned in the journal. Meanwhile, Ari continued his strategy of writing guest posts on popular blogs, which now linked back to the Kickstarter page, and answered online questions related to morning routines, productivity, and habits. Morning Sidekick made just under $20,000 on the campaign. After it ended, they launched an Indiegogo campaign, using a refreshed version of their Kickstarter content. Indiegogo promoted the campaign to its large mailing list, which brought them more sales. They also got the word out through journalists, talking to anyone who would listen. Notice the theme here? These guys hustled. Two strategies helped most of all. They offered a free PDF of the first week of the Morning Sidekick journal to help people get signed up for the newsletter, and they created step-by-step action guides for their articles, fillable PDFs you could get after giving them an email address. Then they'd market the journal to the people on that list with the goal of achieving consistent sales over time. So far, they've sold almost 4,000 units of the Morning Sidekick journal, which cost $33.99 on their website and a bit less on Amazon.com and various flash sale sites. They manufacture the journals in China, store them in a warehouse in Los Angeles, and then ship them to buyers as they're ordered. Halfway through this process, Ari had moved to New York to begin a master's program in tax law, all while continuing to work with his partners remotely. He moved back to Los Angeles when he finished the program and went to work on Habit Nest full-time. Through sales from the growing website and newsletter, the three founders are able to consistently make $6,500 in net profit each month. They've now set their sights on more goals, an app, and an additional series of journals. Critical factor. Ari and his friends wanted to help people be more productive, but their first attempt, an email accountability matching service, didn't pan out. They regrouped and asked themselves what else they could try that still fit with the goal. From that brainstorming session, the Morning Sidekick journal came to life. At the end of each chapter, I have a brief section called Side Hustle Labs, where you'll learn a bit more about the topic featured in the chapter. So here's the first one, Side Hustle Labs. What is a side hustle? You may have heard the phrase side hustle before picking up this book, and maybe you even have one yourself. But what is it exactly? Since side hustle can mean a lot of different things, let's get specific on how I use it here. A side hustle is not a second job or other form of employment that you go to after your 9-to-5 or whatever your main gig is. It's not something that drains your energy without providing a substantial reward. And it's not just a hobby or something you do for fun without any goal of making money. A side hustle is something you have control over, where you're the one making the decisions. It's an asset you build for yourself so that you have more options, even if you love your job. And it's a different kind of work than what you do for your day job. In other words, a side hustle should be both profitable and fun. For more on this, visit sidehustleschool.com/basics. Chapter 2, Ideas Are Everywhere. By mastering the skill of observation, you'll learn to spot opportunities wherever you go. That's what the people featured in this chapter did, and the results speak for themselves. Copywriter carves 140 characters into cash. A creative director and copywriter makes an April Fool's joke that turns into a long-term income stream. Ever since high school, Brian Thompson aspired to be an entrepreneur. He had no shortage of ideas, and he dutifully wrote them down in a growing stack of notebooks. Sometimes he'd even buy a domain name, but then he'd lose interest and move on to something else. After he'd settled down and began raising a family, something clicked, and he began to take more action on those ideas. He created a line of Valentine's Day cards for people who hate Valentine's Day. A Kickstarter campaign for passive-aggressive notepads was successful in meeting its goal. These projects were small, but encouraging. As he continued to experiment in the off hours from his day job in advertising, he grew bolder and began looking back at those notebooks he'd filled up years earlier. His greatest success to date started as a joke. On April 1st, 2014, Brian launched a site offering to turn digital tweets, or posts to Twitter, into physical works of art. He hoped that people would share the site, but he didn't think that much else would come from it. Would anyone really value their 140-character message enough to shell out real money for it to be engraved on a plaque? It turns out that they did. The site was picked up by several popular design blogs, and people started placing orders, some as gifts for friends or office mates, and others for themselves. Without much publicity, all of a sudden he was making several hundred dollars a week. Even better, the orders didn't stop after the initial buzz died down. It helped that the finished pieces were essentially a marketing campaign. Most people displayed them on their desk or in another prominent location, and anyone who walked by would take notice and ask, "What's that?" Interestingly, around this time, Twitter itself got involved by sending him what he calls the world's nicest cease and desist letter. They didn't tell him to stop the project. They just asked him to modify the name. So he changed his site from permanentretweet.com to permanent140.com and carried on with the engraving. Quick side note here, astute listeners will note that Twitter now allows 280 characters instead of the original 140. Brian jokes that he hasn't doubled his prices in response. A few months later, he got another letter from Twitter. This time, however, they were asking him to work at one of their events. Up to this point, Brian had been using a third-party service to do his engravings. After agreeing to work at the event, however, he made a big decision to invest in his own laser engraving machine. After the site had been up for a while, Brian realized that the one-off sales were nice, but the real potential for this hustle came from doing larger orders for brands and events like weddings and bar mitzvahs. He created a new site called lasersmakeitawesome.com to offer custom laser engraving for these events. To his surprise, wooden nickels and tokens have been his best seller. Businesses love handing out something small but personalized, and it's great word of mouth for his side hustle as well. More than 4 years later, Brian is still operating the project part-time. His income has dropped off quite a bit from the $50,000 a year it was making in the beginning, but he still earns at least five figures from it. For him, the best part about this April Fool's Day project has been the flexibility it gives him to freelance and be more selective about the projects he takes on. Gaining freedom from financial pressure is no joke. Critical factor, it was just a crazy idea, but Brian wondered, what if someone would actually pay for this? By installing an order button on a website he'd first started as a joke, he got back his answer in cash. Itchy Honeymoon shaves way to pubic oil profit. Two friends embrace the reality of pubic area discomfort and build a hair care oil product from scratch, turning it into a money-making business despite the skepticism of literally every person they talk to. David Gaylord was on a trip with a good friend when the side hustle of this story came to life. His friend, Tim, had recently returned from his honeymoon. He was excited about a personal discovery and just had to share it with David. The discovery was an intimate one. He had been using beard oil in his pubic region, and it was working wonders. Now, before you cringe, consider the benefits of beard oil on a man's face. It reduces irritation and redness after shaving. It soothes sensitive or dry skin. It reduces the risk of ingrown hairs. And it makes him smell nice. The discomforts that beard oil can remedy don't just apply to faces. They exist in the pubic area as well. The thing is, nobody talks about these issues, except on Side Hustle School, of course, because they have to do with the more private area of the body. After dispelling the weird feelings that came with hearing about Tim's new hygiene habit, David caught on to the opportunity. They'd been looking for a side hustle. Could this be it? The fact that no one was talking about such a thing meant that there was effectively zero competition, at least not yet. And to be among the first in the pubic oil space, they had no time to beat around the bush. David and Tim returned to Ottawa. In their spare time, they began researching ingredients, nutrition, and essential oils. They discovered that the basic beard oils worked okay, but they refined the recipes to be even more suited for the pubic region. They also wanted their product to be relevant for both men and women. They continually worked up better recipes, but with each step that took them closer to a sellable product, the more hesitant they became. For some reason, their family and friends didn't understand why they were pursuing such an odd idea. "You're going to sell what?" was a typical response. Despite the lack of support, they kept at it. They couldn't let the pubic profit potential go. David eventually rounded up some other friends who were willing to take the product for a spin. He invited them over to have a testing party, where they narrowed down their recipe options through feedback. And by the way, despite my otherwise rigorous investigation for Side Hustle School stories, I decided not to ask about how they acquired this feedback. After having a chance to actually try it, family and friends were on board. This was further confirmation to David and Tim that they could convert skeptics into customers, if they could just get samples into their hands. With a product ready to sell, it was time to figure out manufacturing. Each partner threw in $250, which covered the bill for their Shopify store, packaging, and 100 bottles worth of precious pubic oil. Finally, from the strange passion of two men with little outside support, Bush Balm officially launched. Things started off slowly, a sale here, a sale there. They didn't invest a single dollar into advertising, relying only on word of mouth. Luckily, two popular blogs responded to David's cold emails. Bush Balm saw a major boost in sales from the press, and before long, the 100 bottles were sold out. And to everyone's surprise, the orders kept rolling in. They clearly displayed a wait time of over a month in their online store, but customers continued to order. It was clear that they had found something special. The two friends were tapping into a severely underserved niche, all because of their willingness to go there. The Bush Balm team reinvested all the income back into the business, purchasing 500 bottles of oil for their next order. With the extra money, they also began experimenting with ads to drive traffic and sales more consistently. Through feedback, David realized that the $25 price tag was too high for many people who were skeptical of the new oil category. They needed a less expensive way to get product into their hands. The solution was to introduce a sampler package, 3 cents, 2 milliliters each, for just $10. Included in this sample was a discount on the next purchase. Despite actually losing a couple of dollars on each sample package, Bush Balm has found that it's been an effective way to acquire customers who return a few weeks later for larger orders. Bush Balm has now stepped out of the experiment phase. The two friends are spending more money on better ads, reaching out to spas and other retail partners, and eagerly awaiting the arrival of their brand new packaging. What started as an odd yet exciting side hustle has nearly grown into a six-figure business in under 2 years. As it turns out, there was treasure hidden in the bush all along. Critical factor, no one else was willing to go down on this market. Role-playing pastor rolls dice on extra income. This Presbyterian minister was about to burn out. After a series of low-level projects, he learned how to save time, sell products, and turn his role-playing passion into profit. For David Dearest, his full-time job as a Presbyterian minister is a labor of love, but it's never been quite enough to pay the bills. In order to help him continue to serve his local parish, he spent his adult life fitting in odd jobs around his church duties. Among other things, he's tried dog walking, handiwork, and house sitting. Although some of these gigs were good for a while, they never provided him with the consistent support he needed. They were also a huge drain on his time and energy. On the verge of burnout, David decided he wanted a side hustle where he didn't have to exchange time for money. When he talked about this problem with a member of his church, the parishioner recommended that David check out a little podcast called Side Hustle School. He said it was filled with stories of people who'd achieved the same goals he had, and it just might help him find a profitable idea. When David got home that evening, he downloaded an episode and was instantly hooked. After just a few episodes, he figured out what he needed to do. Instead of selling his time, he was going to sell a product. For the next several weeks, David took a close look at his life and interests. He didn't want to sell a product he knew nothing about, like some people were doing. He wanted to sell something that mattered to him. Ever since he was a young boy, he'd been interested in role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons. It was a way for a self-described awkward teenager to meet like-minded people. He also figured it might be a good place to start in his hunt for a way to make money without walking dogs or repairing dishwashers. David paid a visit to his local gaming group and got to talking with a friend who was showing off his new custom dice. He told his friend he had dice envy and was instantly struck with both an idea and a name for his new venture. With low startup costs and a market he understood, dice seemed like a simple product to sell. Getting straight to work, David put together some simple sketches of what he thought could make a good-looking set of dice. He sent them to a designer friend, who turned them into an Adobe file that could be sent to a potential manufacturer. Finding that manufacturer was less of a scientific process and more of a Hail Mary. He went to Alibaba.com, found someone who made dice, put it in an order, and hoped he wasn't about to get ripped off by someone on the other side of the world. A supplier put him at ease when he delivered the dice ahead of schedule. With his product ready, David took Dice Envy online, setting up a site through Squarespace. He found platforms to sell his product on Facebook, eBay, and through his own website, allowing him to reach lots of new people organically. The total startup cost came in at around $3,000. This included his initial investment in the dice, creation of the website, legal fees, and advertising the initial release of his first set. While this was slightly more money than he intended to spend, the investment has more than paid for itself. In its first year, Dice Envy was bringing in around $2,800 a month. Sales then spiked, hitting a pair of lucky sixes and rising to $9,000 per month in year two. Because of the visual aspect of the product, these custom dice have been easy to market through social media. Instagram and Pinterest help catch people's attention and refer them back to David's website. And his posts on Facebook send people directly to a checkout page where they can purchase. He's also tried his hand at advertising, but with less success. With his initial launch of the product, he left an ad running for 1 week too long and ended up spending more on that ad than the entire launch had made. Deliveries can also be a stressful part of the business, especially since his shipments arrive from the other side of the world. Knowing when and how much to order is still an art form that David is trying to master. Despite the challenges, he loves his new project and is looking for ways to expand. He's now implementing a subscription system for people to get new dice every month, as well as selling in person at gaming conventions. With his wedding on the horizon, David is using the extra cash to help pay for the ceremony. He's also able to do his pastoral work without constantly stressing about money. Critical factor. David knew the role-playing world, and he believed he could create a set of dice that other gamers would want. Despite never having sourced items from overseas, he was able to figure it out and get started quickly with a minimally designed website. This story has an action plan. Step one, identify a product and a clear market. In this case, a custom dice for role-playing gamers. Step two, design the dice with the help of a friend. Step three, research manufacturers on Alibaba or similar networks. Step four, place an initial order while building a website. And step five, sell the dice and plan to expand. Landscaper stops mowing lawns, starts producing podcasts. A Canadian landscaper lands on the side hustle trifecta: passion, skill, and opportunity. He eventually uses his new income to quit his job and travel to 10 countries. Back in early 2016, Jeremy Enns was working at a landscaping job in Vancouver, British Columbia, a job he knew he didn't want to do forever. The search for a side hustle had a natural starting point. Jeremy had gone to school for audio engineering and production, and he loved podcasts. While mowing lawns and trimming hedges, he listened to episodes nonstop, sometimes up to 50 hours a week at double speed. As he started thinking about doing podcast editing and production, he realized that there was a significant audience for those services. He had hit that side hustle trifecta of passion, skill, and opportunity. The first step was to reach out to some friends who had their own podcast. He wanted to learn more about their workflow and understand how they found their editor. One of those friends put him in touch with another guy who worked as a freelancer for a podcast production company. After connecting with him, Jeremy started doing some freelance editing of his own for the same company. While he was seeing who else he could connect with in his network, he was also actively trying to land his first client. He combed through the listings on Apple Podcasts to identify 100 shows that were big enough that they might be able to hire an editor, but not so established that they would already have one. Then he sent 100 individual emails, hoping for a 5 to 10% conversion rate. Unfortunately, he only received a single response that led to a paying client. The good news was that this cold email campaign wasn't his only marketing idea. At the same time, he was also applying for audio production gigs on Upwork.com, a network of opportunities for freelancers. Within a week, he had landed another client, and the validation gave him a boost. Over the next 3 months, Jeremy continued to learn and experiment. His initial website had focused on helping indie musicians who wanted to record albums. Since he now wanted to produce podcasts, he needed to adjust the copy and pricing options. With some minor changes and no additional marketing, Jeremy continued to get new clients via word of mouth and Upwork. At the 90-day point, he hired a graphic designer to make an infographic for his site. That was literally the first expense he incurred, since he hadn't spent a single dollar until then. He also signed up for a few low-cost tools to help him organize and manage some administrative processes. In all these efforts, he tried to keep things as cheap and simple as possible. As he approached the half-year mark in his new role, Jeremy started thinking about turning podcast production into his full-time work. He made a deal with himself. Once he'd saved enough money for 3 months' expenses, he'd quit his job. He figured if it didn't work out, the landscaping job, or another job, would still be there for him to fall back on. Therefore, on August 15th, 2016, he gave notice to his employer. The best part of this story is that Jeremy had money coming in from multiple clients, and he hadn't actually totaled up all the income he was making. A couple of weeks after he gave his notice, he finally did the math and realized that he had made more money that month on his side hustle than with his day job. That was the moment he knew he had made the right decision. Within a couple of months of quitting his day job, he was bringing in an average of $4,000 a month, more than enough for him at that point in his life. Since going full-time, he's turned all his energy to his podcast production hustle. He wrote an ebook on podcasting gear. He got serious about email marketing. And about a year and a half after starting up, he brought on a couple of freelancers of his own to help with all the work. Not only has this transition paid off financially, it's had other major benefits. After launching, Jeremy spent 10 of the next 19 months traveling across 4 continents and 13 countries. He has less free time since he's now managing his own company and freelancers, but the freedom he's gained and the ability to pick his own direction in life more than makes up for the lost hours. He also has a new podcast of his own, focused on another of his favorite topics, ice cream. Yep, that's right. Jeremy's goal for the new show, Rain City Scoop, is for it to become the go-to source for all things ice cream. It's unclear if this one has the same financial potential as his podcast editing gig, but he certainly has the passion and the skill. Critical factor. Jeremy's skill in audio production, combined with his love for podcasts, led to a freelance turned full-time role where he earned as much money in his day job while working half the time. This story has an action plan. Just 3 steps here. Step 1, put together a simple pricing structure that answers any questions your potential client might have. Make it clear so they understand exactly what they're getting and how much it costs. Step 2, get experience however you can, even if it means volunteering your services for free. You shouldn't work for free for long, but sometimes it can help get you in the door. And step 3, a service business runs on referrals. Jeremy was far more successful in gaining business from happy customers than he was in cold pitching every podcast he could find. Ask each customer if they can help you find more clients. German funeral urns are not a dying business. 2 friends learned to manufacture funeral urns that double as personalized works of art. Daniel Mack works as a product development manager for a large building material company in an English town that borders Wales. His side hustle is selling handcrafted funeral urns to private customers and funeral directors. He does this with his friend Marco Billmeyer, who's based in a small town close to Heidelberg, Germany. Marco works for a company producing industrial cameras and was into street art, painting, and tattoos. One day, he passed by a funeral director's storefront and had an unusual idea. A big set of funeral urns was on display, but they had almost no variants in their design. If you wanted to honor your loved one with something colorful or creative, there was simply no option. Marco thought this was a business he and Daniel could go into, providing a genuine alternative. At first, Daniel thought his friend was crazy, but he agreed to give it a try. How does one go about making funeral urns? Well, Daniel and Marco started by sourcing raw materials from a funeral director, and they built a single web page using the platform Wix. The page didn't have any way to purchase, just a request form and phone number for people to call and ask questions. After doing some research on search engine keywords, they spent about $200 marketing the page using Google AdWords to see if there was any interest. The process was slow since they both had day jobs and were in separate countries, but 6 months later, they felt it was promising, so they decided to proceed. They compiled a list of funeral directors who bought urns for their customers on a regular basis. Their simple webpage slowly grew into an online shop with photos and a portfolio. And over time, they built Momenti Urns into a real business. The two friends now sell several kinds of urns: wooden, ceramic, marble, and biodegradable. The urns come in a wide selection of colors and beautiful designs, including butterflies, angels, bicycles, lighthouses, and religious symbols. They've had as many as 200 different designs available at one time, and more than 600 urns available to ship as soon as an order has been placed. They also sell sets that allow customers to paint on the urns themselves. And after they'd been going for a while, they started to offer the option to purchase customized urns. In short, whatever you can imagine in a funeral urn, they've probably got an option for it. Since they live in different areas, Daniel and Marco call each other weekly to discuss issues, as well as communicate via email and WhatsApp throughout the week. They outsource website programming, writing, flyer and brochure creation, packaging, shipping, and preparation. Momenti Urns has now been around for nearly 3 years, selling an average of 40 urns a month and bringing in an average income of $5,000 a month. They hope to eventually expand to the rest of Europe, and they're now working with a freelancer on an ad campaign targeting funeral directors. With an intention to help people honor their loved ones after death, this business is full of life. Critical factor. A creative idea meets a renewing market, and one with essentially no competition. The biggest challenge was winning over a traditional industry that was typically opposed to change. Santa's letter-writing gig hustles down the chimney. An inspired elf starts a month-long part-time project writing personalized letters from Santa Claus. Santa Claus might sit around and get fat most of the year, but come December, this jolly old man becomes overwhelmed. He gets so much mail that it's hard to keep up. Even in our hyper-connected world, a lot of people prefer to communicate with Santa in the old-fashioned social network known as letter writing. And recently, he's found some seasonal help from a creative thinker. Right out of college, Brie Laria spent all of her savings on a 4-month backpacking trip. Upon her return, she got a part-time job as a waitress in Yakima, Washington, while her boyfriend at the time worked on a political campaign. With a lot of time on her hands, she knew she needed to make more money, but she was also just bored. A side gig would help in lots of ways, but what would it be? Brie sat down and asked herself what she was good at. She knew she was a strong writer, but she didn't have time to write a book. She had previously tried her hand at writing resumes, and that didn't work well. Maybe there was another option. She's not completely sure how the idea showed up, but one day she started advertising a service that promised handwritten letters from Santa. She posted on Craigslist, Facebook, and Tumblr, but got no response at first. She then included a few pictures of the ones she had drafted, but they looked corny and low quality. She learned quickly that parents wouldn't pay for something they could easily do themselves. So she sat down once again, discouraged but determined, and mapped out how she could improve the letters. She focused first on personalization. She would learn key things about a child from a list of questions and customize the letter, making sure they knew Santa was watching and that he was proud of them. She also upped her game with better printing and design. But here's the winning element. Brie started to advertise that these deluxe letters had an option that included reindeer food. What parent who loved Christmas didn't want to watch their child leave out magic reindeer food on Christmas Eve? By the way, since you're learning her secrets, the reindeer food is discounted birdseed from her local pet store, with a little glitter mixed in. This turned out to be the Santa letter jackpot. She advertised her letters as the most personalized option on the market, with attention to detail and reindeer food to boot. And it worked. All of a sudden, she was making more sales than she could handle. The first year, she sold around 300 letters at $9.95 each, or a deluxe package at $11.95. The letters cost her about $1.50 each to write and package, so she made around $4,000. The second year, she sold about 400 and raised the prices slightly to $11.95 and $13.95, respectively. However, she outsourced the writing of the letters to a virtual assistant she found online, so her profit margin was slightly less. This time, they cost about $3 to write and package. The third year, something interesting happened. After first thinking she wouldn't do it again, because even with outsourcing to elves, it was a lot of work, she finally decided to go for it, but started late and did very little marketing. However, here's the surprise. She raised her prices to $19.95 and $26.95, so in doing less work, she actually made a lot more money. That year, she sold 250 letters and made just under $6,000. Naturally, this is a seasonal hustle. You can't sell Santa letters in July. She typically begins the process around November 15th, and letters are sent by December 10th. For something she does once a year, it's a great payoff. She also regularly receives replies in the form of letters from kids thanking Santa for their personalized message. Let this be a reminder. You'd better watch out, you'd better not pout, and you'd better get to work. Critical factor. With a low price, sending your child a letter from Santa, or perhaps his helper, is an easy impulse purchase, and the reindeer food makes for an ideal upsell. This story has an action plan. Step 1. Identify an opportunity to create surprise and delight for parents and children. It needn't be seasonal like this story. What if the letters came from the tooth fairy and arrived a few days after a child lost a tooth? Step 2. Consider the needs and concerns of parents, your actual customers, since they're the ones spending the money, and make sure they have a way to provide input or at least review the letters prior to sending. Step 3, create a personalized touch, just like reindeer food, that helps you stand out and provides the opportunity for an upsell. Last, step 4, market your service using free or low-cost methods. Who do you know that can help spread the word? Fidget spinner cookie crumbles into cash. A viral sensation inspires a TV producer to create an edible fidget spinner cookie. Based in Dallas, Texas, Jessica Gross is the executive producer of a popular YouTube channel. For the past 10 years, she's worked on TV shows including Oprah, Ricky Lake, The Rosie O'Donnell Show, and TMZ. Her side hustle is unrelated to the entertainment business, or at least it's not directly related, because Jessica bakes delicious custom cookies with unique designs. When it started, she took cookie orders from friends and family, accepting cash or checks for around $3 a cookie. She'd make the cookies in the shape of dump trucks for a kid's birthday party, or in the shape of pink feet for a baby shower. At some point, Jessica made a Facebook page and set up accounts with PayPal and Venmo to receive payment. With this simple setup, she had a steady stream of customers, enough to keep her busy baking and delivering her creations after work and on the weekends. She kept things simple for years, taking her side hustle with her to multiple jobs in different states. She was having fun and making some extra money with no plans to strike it rich. But then, at the end of May 2017, Jessica made a fidget spinner cookie, and it went viral. The trail of cookie crumbs got picked up by publications nationwide and was featured on the Food Network. In the weeks that followed, she gained thousands of social media followers and made hundreds of sales. It led to some late nights of baking in order to fulfill all her orders, but she wasn't complaining. While her fidget spinner cookie story was still going around the world, the CEO of T-Mobile tweeted about it. So Jessica, proactive hustler that she is, reached out to the public relations representative at the company and offered to make some T-Mobile branded cookies and spinners. They happily accepted, and the CEO gave her another shout out, posting photos all over social media. One phone call and one batch of cookies led to some priceless marketing for Jessica. Her average cookie now sells for $5, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending on the amount of time required to design and decorate the specific cookie. And since her customer base is now nationwide, instead of just her own zip code, she's had to learn to ship cookies in such a way that they don't break. All the attention has translated to an average of $2,000 a month in new sales. Following a trend is not normally a good business strategy. Once in a while, though, being in the right place at the right time and with the right idea can pay off. Don't let the cookie crumble. Critical factor: a worldwide craze for fidget spinners coincided with Jessica's knack for baking cookies in unusual shapes. When the Food Network noticed, sales surged. Florida woman gets paid to remove poisonous toads. A high school science teacher earns an extra $3,000 a month removing an invasive species of toads throughout Florida. If something ribbits in your neighborhood, who are you going to call? Toadbusters. Or more specifically, you'll call Janine Tilford, the owner of a most unusual side business in South Florida. After spotting a dangerous shift in her local environment, this high school science teacher decided to take matters into her own hands, earning an extra $2,000 to $3,000 a month along the way. A herpetologist by trade, Janine had noticed the diversity of the local reptiles, animals she loved to collect and study, had begun to dwindle, and the rate of dogs dying from eating poisonous toads was on the rise. This destruction was all thanks to one particular species, the nefarious bufo toad. The system of getting rid of these toads with pesticides was effective, but expensive and damaging to nearby flora and fauna. There was no way to get rid of the toads without making the rest of the area sterile. Unless someone went out each night to collect the toads by hand and remove them one by one. That's where Janine found her calling, or at least a highly unusual side gig. She felt that if she could be the one to go out and collect the toads, it would be the perfect part-time evening job to boost her modest teacher's salary. So that's what she did. Initial startup costs for Toadbusters came in at around $2,100. Among other expenses, Janine needed a license to remove the toads, that was $100, and some sort of pest control insurance, that was $800 a year. Unlike the crew from Ghostbusters, however, she didn't have to invest in an untested, unlicensed nuclear accelerator to carry on her back. Instead, she spent the rest of the money on a high-visibility jacket, as well as gloves, headlamps, toad carriers, and advertising for the side of her vehicle. Needless to say, this job comes with a lot of perils. It's highly active work and requires climbing into areas where there are plenty of mosquitoes, spiders, venomous snakes, and alligators. That's even without the poltergeist coming after you. Each toad has to be picked up by hand. One night, Janine retrieved a record-setting 138 reptiles near a pond at a country club in South Florida. Unfortunately, she doesn't get paid per toad. From time to time, Janine also finds herself explaining to the police why she's walking around someone else's property late at night with a flashlight and a big stick. Toad removal requires strict regulations to be followed, but disposing of these excess frogs pays well. When we last spoke, Toadbusters was bringing in at least $3,000 a month, with Janine working just a few nights each month.